Today we're looking at Deuteronomy chapter 20, and I'll read the chapter first, as usual. Deuteronomy 20. When you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. So it shall be, when you are on the verge of battle, that the priest shall approach and speak to the people. And he shall say to them, Hear, O Israel, today you are on the verge of battle with your enemies. Do not let your heart faint, do not be afraid, and do not tremble or be terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to save you. Then the officer shall speak to the people, saying, What man is there who has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man dedicate it. Also, what man is there who has planted a vineyard and has not eaten of it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man eat of it. And what man is there who is betrothed to a woman and has not married her? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man marry her. The officer shall speak further to the people and say, What man is there who is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return to his house, lest the heart of his brethren faint like his heart. And so it shall be, when the officers have finished speaking to the people, that they shall make captains of the armies to lead the people. When you go near to a city to fight against it, then proclaim an offer of peace to it. And it shall be that if they accept your offer of peace and open to you, then all the people who are found in it shall be placed under tribute to you and serve you. Now if the city will not make peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. And when the Lord your God delivers it into your hands, you shall strike every male in it with the edge of the sword. But the women, the little ones, the livestock, and all that is in the city, all its spoil, you shall plunder for yourself. And you shall eat the enemy's plunder which the Lord your God gives you. Thus you shall do to all the cities which are very far from you, which are not of the cities of these nations. But of the cities of these peoples, which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance, you shall let nothing that breathes remain alive, but you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite and the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite, just as the Lord your God has commanded you. Lest they teach you to do according to all their abominations which they have done for their gods, and you sin against the Lord your God. When you besiege a city for a long time while making war against it to take it, you shall not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them. If you can eat of them, do not cut them down to use in the siege, for the tree of the field is man's food. Only the trees which you know are not trees for food, you may destroy and cut down, to build siege works against the city that makes war with you, until it is subdued. Interesting that part of the discussion today is fruit trees. Probably not many passages in the Bible quite like that. Okay, in our study in Deuteronomy, we've seen that the focus, at least in the last chapter in this one, we will see, is on the sixth commandment, you shall not kill. And just as in the last chapter where we talked about accidental manslaughter, whatever the right term is, and although it wasn't a violation of the commandment to kill someone accidentally without malice, still it is concerned with the tenth commandment because God sets a value on the life of man who is made in his image. So just as that was the case in the last chapter, so here in this chapter we're talking about war. And in general, killing in war is not a violation of the sixth commandment. God, in fact, commands the people to go out to battle in faith. So it's not really concerned, you might say, directly with violations of the sixth commandment, but rather with the larger thought behind the commandment, which is, as I said, the value that God places on human life. And we'll see in this chapter that even though there are commands concerning war and regulations concerning war, much of the undertone is about the restraint that should be exercised in war and the disincentives to war which are in the background. So I'm going to split this up according to the three sections. The first section, verses 1 through 9, about these general commands for going to war, and then The second gives the two cases, the cities outside of the land and the cities in the land. And then the third is about the fruit trees. Interesting section. So the first part, verses 1 through 9, talks about the general commands. And these are applicable to many of the situations, especially the trust in God. That's the way the chapter opens, that they should not fear. God has commanded them to this fight in this battle. That's the assumption. I'll come back to that assumption in a minute. But the assumption is that God has commanded them to battle. And because of that, because God is the powerful one, notice at the end of verse 1, the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. So God was able to overthrow the Egyptians, you might say, against all odds. Because of who God is, because he will be with them, because he will fight for you, in verse 4, therefore they should not be afraid. And in case they missed the point, that's said four times. I don't know if you noticed it. It's said at the end of, in the middle of verse 1, do not be afraid of them. It's said three times in verse 3, in slightly different words, but do not let your heart faint, do not be afraid, do not tremble or be terrified because of them. Now, when God says things four times, it's first of all because we need to hear them four times. So there is a temptation for them to be afraid. And the short explanation of that temptation is given in verse 1. They will see horses and chariots and people more numerous than them. Okay, so to paraphrase, I think it's the local hospital's radio ads, the Canaanites had the technology. Okay, so they had the chariots and horses, and in fact, if you look later on in Joshua 11:4, it says exactly this: when they come up against the Canaanites, they're numerous and they have horses and chariots. Okay? And this is a severe disadvantage for any army. They're outnumbered, and they also don't have the state-of-the-art technology for warfare. But even though that's the case, God commands them not to be afraid, because God is fighting for them. And a parallel passage for meditation this afternoon, if you want to think more about this, is in 2 Chronicles 20, where Jehoshaphat, the later king of the southern kingdom, faces numerous enemies, and he says to God, in effect, they're more numerous than we are, but what difference does it make? As long as you fight for us, as long as the Lord is on our side. So the encouragement here is that as they face battle, as they go, whether it's to fight against the Canaanites in the immediate future, that's what they're preparing for, or whether there are other battles that they fight on their borders, they should be confident that God is the powerful one and God will be strengthening them. This verse about the horses and chariots may make you think of Psalm 20, where we like to sing that, you know, some trust in their horses and in their chariots, but we boast in the name of the Lord our God. And that's the whole tenor of the passage, to trust in God, not to trust in your advantages, even if you have advantages, but especially when you see the power of the enemy. Now, this is enforced in a way that you can almost see in a film. So they're all lined up for battle, and here the priest gives this commandment in verse 3, and it's short and to the point. You know, you can see them standing before the battle line saying, do not let your heart faint, for the Lord is with you. Now, that command then to fear is not to fear is complemented by the exemptions that are granted in the verses that follow. And this is sort of an interesting section, because it says that the officers, after this commandment not to fear, will speak to the people, and there are four exemptions, military exemptions, if you want to think of them that way, that are granted beginning in verse 5. Three of them have to do with the normal life in the land. Okay, now you have to keep in mind they're not in the land yet. This is an anticipation of that. But the three exemptions that are mentioned first have to do with the fact that they would have built a new house and they wanted to enjoy that house and live in it, that they would have a new vineyard and wanted to enjoy the fruit of it. There's an extra fact which is not mentioned here but is mentioned in Leviticus, and that is when they planted a vineyard, they had to wait a certain period of time before they could enjoy the fruit. Okay, so they would already have had to wait it a while before they could enjoy the fruit, and now they have to go off to war, and they're granted an exemption in that case. And the third case is that is mentioned here is a new betrothal. Okay, so it's not a marriage. It says in verse 7, he's betrothed to a woman and has not married her. So it's the deal is sealed, I guess we would say, but the marriage hasn't been consummated, and that is another cause for an exemption. Later on in Deuteronomy, after a man is married, he also has a year of exemption. So there is a provision made for after the marriage as well. So in all of these, it's a striking thing to realize that here they're actually reducing the size of their army, right? These are people who would otherwise be fit for battle, but God, as Matthew Henry points out, is not a hard master forcing people to go to war in these circumstances. Instead, God gives them these exemptions. These are people whose thoughts probably wouldn't be on the battle. They might be on their vineyard back home, or probably on their bride-to-be. And so God kindly gives them these exemptions. And those are, you might say, understandable in terms of the circumstances of life. And I want to come back to that in terms of what the meaning would be for their lives. But the fourth exemption is one that maybe deserves a separate treatment, and that's in verse 8. It's an exemption for the fearful, for the faint-hearted. So he says to them that they are excused. Now, of course, the whole point of the opening section was that they should trust in God, and therefore the people who were faint-hearted were not buying into that system, if you want to put it that way. They refused to trust in God. They had, for some reason, great difficulty in that. But the specific reason that's mentioned here in verse 8 is that lest the heart of his brethren faint like his heart. Okay, you don't want a bunch of cowards, right, fighting in the midst of the army. You may be excused, it says, in fact. And this may bring to mind Gideon. Remember, Gideon made several cuts in his army. Well, the first cut was those who were faint-hearted. The reference is in, there's somewhere, Judges 7. And the situation is similar there as it is here. So I want to think a little bit about the application of this in the immediate context of the Israelites, what this would have meant for them. And then it'll probably be toward the end of the study today as we think about how it applies in pointing forward to Christ, how the whole chapter does. But the first thing is to notice, as I mentioned at the beginning, that there's a commandment here involving going to war. Okay. So the Bible does not support pacifism. I don't know if anyone's surprised by that, but the sixth commandment doesn't rule out fighting in battle. And again, it was assumed that they would be fighting in the name and strength of the Lord, that they would be fighting with faith, in other words, in God. There is a danger associated with that, and that is that in the, you might say, optional battles, there was a clear command to go forth and remove the Canaanites. But beyond that, the chapter treats the other cases. And in cases like that where the rulers have to make a decision, there's always a danger of assuming that God is commanding them to go to war. There's a danger of assuming that God is on their side. Okay, and that, sorry, there's a Dylan song with that name, but you know, that there is in this chapter, as I already mentioned, a sort of an undertone of warning about the dangers of the war, of going to war, and how destructive it is. And I thought I would read just one quotation from Calvin. This is a longer quotation, is actually tied in more with verse 13 in the second part that we're going to be looking at. But he mentions how the whole chapter should really make us think and make the rulers think about what they do when they go to war. He says, "Surely such shedding of blood ought to make the hair to stand up upon our heads." And then he goes on from there and says, Therefore, it behooves men to have the more stay of themselves beforehand, to consider thus, what a thing is it to come to battle, wherein so many murders are to be committed, and so many slaughters are to be done, as though the whole world should go to confusion, and all bonds of nature were to be forgotten, and men should shut their eyes willfully to the intent they might not see whether the folk whom they murder be men or not. Let such as take wars in hand look well to themselves and bethink themselves thus. What I must come to the sacking of a city, and so from one to another, and battle upon battle shall be fought? What a number of poor widows and fatherless children shall be made thereby? What a heap of confusions will ensue thereof, so as you would think that the whole world should be turned upside down? And shall I be the cause of all this? If princes considered that they should fall into such extremities by taking wars in hand, surely they would deal much more mildly than they do. Now, again, the point is not that war is sinful or a violation of the sixth commandment, but rather that war does destroy life, and just as we saw in the last chapter, even an accidental killing is a serious thing before God. Now, in the passage we've been looking at, there are, you might say, disincentives to ambitious rulers. If the ruler says, well, this little country on my border bothers me, I think I'll go to war against them, and he has a habit of doing so, he's going to find more and more men who've built a house and taken a wife and planted a vineyard. Right? More and more men will say, you know, I think I'm afraid today and I don't want to go to battle. There are disincentives built into the system to the ambitious ruler, and incentives, if you have an ambitious ruler, to thinking in the long term, right? Let's build a house. Let's plant a vineyard. Let's do something that's for the good of society. And by the way, then we won't have to join in this folly of the ruler and go forth to war. So Gary North in particular develops this point, and he has some very helpful comments on the whole chapter in terms of the way a good ruler will instead want the people to support what he's doing. And it's a voluntary force, voluntary in the sense that the exemptions are broad enough that many people could claim them. So you would really want to make sure in a situation like this that you don't think that God is on your side or claim that God is on your side when it's really merely your own ambition. So those are some of the comments that we could make about the opening verses 1 through 9 and the general comments. They're really worked out in two particular cases that we'll look at, but let me pause and see if I've made anyone mad at me yet. Any comments or questions?
Yeah. Any idea how long a typical betrothal period was? For some reason, I had an idea that it could be quite long.
I don't know. But I suppose you could adjust it to look at the term limits of the ruler.
You know, your parents betroth you when you're 15, and then when you've made your living in the world, then finally you get married.
Right. Yeah. The woman might not appreciate that, sure. But yeah. No, that's right.
Yeah. I'm going off the top of my head, but it seems like Deuteronomy is a bit early to be speaking of chariots, or maybe. And I'm just thinking of iron chariots, because Judges brings up, which is much later, this encounter with iron chariots.
Yeah.
Does Deuteronomy specify the type of chariots?
No. The reference in Joshua that I mentioned, Joshua 11:4, just mentions chariots, I think. And this is Jabin, king of Hazor, so I don't know if he had the technology or not. But it says, they went out, they and all their armies with them, as many people as the sand that is on the seashore in multitude, and with very many horses and chariots. So it could be that later in Judges that the technology had advanced.
But it seems like God to control military spending was a problem in 1400 B.C.
Right. Yep.
You mentioned disincentives in the system, but I was also wondering your thoughts on, the justification of that war itself. I was reading some of the Flex Rex this past week, and Rutherford seemed, if I understand correctly, was making the argument that it was not right to go to war just to take someone's land, And he said that the Israelites did that, but they had special commandment of God, but they were also forbidden to take Edom's land, for example.
Right. Yeah. It is kind of interesting. You'd think some of these Reformation-era writers were living in the 60s and carrying posters around against the Vietnam War. No, it wasn't really like that. But I was surprised at how vehemently they criticized the rulers. Calvin called the princes thieves if they didn't go to war for a just cause. I think specifically in Deuteronomy, they are commanded to take the land of the Canaanites. And that's that we've discussed earlier in Deuteronomy. The others, there's no direct command to take this land or that land. So it would have to be a case where there was a sense in which it was justified. But that justification isn't really spelled out here. And that's why I said that if they had a sense that it was justified, then they could, and they believed God, that they had a prophet commanding them to go to battle or something, then they could go in faith that God would be with them. But my point was just that the temptation would be to manufacture excuses and think that God is with them. Does that answer your question? Yeah, I think Rutherford's comment would fit quite well with the point I was trying to make. Yes? I was going to say something toward the end. Not much. That would be worth discussion. And I'm probably not the person, and this is probably not the time to lead it, but yeah. Okay, let's go to verses 10 through 18, which is the second section. And here, as I said, there are two cases given. So the first case is the case of a city near by them, but not a city in the land of Canaan. And then the second case begins really in verse 16 of the cities of the peoples which the Lord your God gives you an inheritance. So that's the total destruction of the Canaanites that we've talked about before in Deuteronomy. So the first case is the case of a city that is nearby, and they go to fight against it, and the first thing they're supposed to do is proclaim an offer of peace to it. So they're not supposed to go in immediately and attack the city, but rather offer terms of peace. And the terms of peace involve that the people would pay tribute and that the people would be in servitude for some period of time after they surrendered. The sort of thing you can see in terms of servitude is what the Gibeonites won. Okay, now the Gibeonites tricked the people of Israel into thinking they were from a far-off city, but the fact that the Gibeonites continued to serve in the history of the nation is an example of the sort of servitude that you would see. That's Joshua 9, a reference for the Gibeonites. So right up front, you can see here there's a certain restraint that's commanded on the part of the people. They're not supposed to immediately go to take the city. They're supposed to avoid shedding blood if possible. But if that offer is refused, then they are to besiege the city. And here the commandment is first that all the males, and it seems to be the adult males, considering the next verse, all the males would be killed, and the ones who are left over, the women and the children, as well as the rest of the city, would be spared by them. Now there's a further disincentive, and Calvin actually mentions this in that quote I read. He was talking about this passage, that if in fact you carry this out, you have all these women and children to care for. Okay, so it's not something that you would go to do thoughtlessly. At least that's the implication. In fact, the next chapter talks about the case where a woman is taken from in a situation like this and how she can be married to a man of Israel and what the provisions are in a situation like that. But it's a significant situation that's being described here because the male population is removed. The infrastructure of the city, if you like, is preserved. What's going to happen to it? Is a neighboring country going to take it over? How are you going to maintain this? And how are you going to care for the people who are left behind? Those are all questions that would be raised by the situation that's implied here. The second case that's mentioned is, as I said, one we've thought about more than once in Deuteronomy. It's not one that it's particularly pleasant to think about, but God commanded them to completely wipe out the Canaanites. There is no, in fact, earlier in chapter 7, it says specifically, you shall not offer peace to them, okay, but instead that you are to wipe them all out, every last one of them. So this harem, that's the Hebrew word that's used for this, has to do with an idea of a sacrifice to God. So they're given over. And there are several reasons that we've seen given earlier in Deuteronomy. The one that's repeated here is in verse 18, lest they teach you to do according to their abominations. So they were to live in the promised land, and for that reason they were to remove not only the Canaanites, but all the remnants of idolatry of the Canaanites. That's also been brought up in Deuteronomy. So they were completely to completely destroy them. It was not my plan to discuss that further. That's a real question. That's something that often, I think Jeff pointed out, often comes up when you discuss with unbelievers who know anything at all about the Bible. You know, what about the genocide against the Canaanites and that sort of thing? I'll just say we've talked about it before. I don't want to go through it again. But it is a special situation, as Logan already mentioned, and it has to do in terms of the typological setting of the Canaanites with the picture of the total destruction of the enemies of God in eternity. There is no quarter offered for those who finally rebel against God. They are completely wiped out. And that we've talked about before. Let's move on then to the last part of the chapter. If you have questions on that, we can take them at the end. But verses 19 and 20. This is about besieging a city. And the passage has already mentioned the case where a city would be besieged. This was a typical practice in the ancient Near East. And it was a typical practice in the ancient Near East to not only build these siege works, but also to build the siege works, let me say it this way, that the siege works they built required a lot of wood. Okay, so they would have to cut down the trees around to build these siege works. You've seen the Lord of the Rings movies, you have some idea of what all this involves. They would also need the wood for fuel. Okay, this is a long-term thing. It says in verse 19, when you besiege a city for a long time. So the army is going to be camped around the city for a while. And the question is the land really going to survive? That is, the land outside, is it going to survive this long siege? And God is here making provision for them so that it would survive. There's evidence from the ancient Near East that the practice was contrary to this. The practice was instead, whether for punitive reasons or for other reasons, to make a devastation of the surrounding countryside. And one reference, maybe we could turn there. So bookmark where we are. Did I use that right, Logan? And turn to 2 Kings 3. This is not a positive example. This is the nation of Israel, and they had some support from the prophets for the war that they fought. But when they went against the Moabites, they did exactly what they're told not to do in Deuteronomy 20. 2 Kings 3:25. This is referring to, it's actually a joint venture of the northern and southern kingdoms, I believe, at least the southern kingdom's king is involved. Then they destroyed the cities, and each man threw a stone on every good piece of land and filled it. And they stopped up all the springs of water and cut down all the good trees. So there you go. But they left the stones of Kir Hareseth intact. However, the slingers surrounded and attacked it. So back to Deuteronomy 20. That's what they're not supposed to do. They're not supposed to make a waste of the land. And in particular, it says that they're not supposed to destroy the fruit trees. Now, that may not have quite the impact for us as it would for them. Okay, obviously they didn't have Walmart. They couldn't just go and get fruit easily. This was a serious consideration. And it was a serious consideration when they were besieging a city within Canaan because they were supposed to inherit Canaan, right? And it says specifically earlier in Deuteronomy that the blessing of God will be that they live in cities they didn't build, and they eat from fruit trees they didn't plant. Okay? Now, how stupid would it be to cut down the fruit trees before you had a chance to eat them? That's the implication, or to put it positively, how gracious God is in pointing out to them that need. And again, I thought I would read from Matthew Henry, where he comments on this and reflects more generally on the practice of war. Matthew Henry, as he usually does, is quite eloquent in his statements. God is a better friend to man than man is to himself. And God's law, which we are apt to complain of as a heavy yoke, consults our interest and comfort, while our own appetites and passions, of which we are so indulgent, are really enemies to our welfare. The intent of many of the divine precepts is to restrain us from destroying that which is our life and food. And then he adds that armies and their commanders are not allowed to make what desolation they please in countries that are the seat of war. Military rage must always be checked and ruled with reason. War, though carried on with ever so much caution, is destructive enough and should not be made more so than is absolutely necessary. So here God shows his care for man. That fits in again with the whole theme of the sixth commandment. It's not the taking of life as much as here the preservation of life. And again, it's a future orientation, right? It's looking ahead to what will happen after the siege, just as the exemptions from the army were encouraging, in effect, at least in a bad administration, encouraging people to invest in the future. So here there's a provision made for them that God's creation should be used for a good purpose and ultimately to future orientation and provision for the people. Now, that's a fairly brief, you may not think so, but a fairly brief summary of the whole chapter. I want to think a little bit about what it says for us and how it points forward to Christ a little bit, and then we can reflect on in the comments and questions further on this. The first thing, starting at the end, Vicki said something about, you know, present-day applications. This verse would seem to argue against having what's called a scorched earth policy. Now, there are difficulties in applying it. This is applied to a specific situation, you know, whether that means you're not supposed to defoliate so you can, you know, get the our enemy in Vietnam, I'm not going to say, but it certainly implies that there should be some care for the population where the battle is going on, and some view to the future when the war is over, and not merely be seized by the immediate need of the moment. Second of all, I would point out this call to proclaim peace, and specifically in verse 10, implies the way, has something to say about the way we should act in general. And again, I thought I would read more quotes than I usually have. I think I haven't had many for a while, so I'm making up for it. But Calvin specifically brings out this point in verse 10 about making an offer of peace and applies it to our own interpersonal relationships. And he says this, "If those whom God hath armed against their enemies may not strike one stroke at them until they have tried to make peace with them, what shall become of us who ought to be men of peace and to love our enemies? If we are irreconcilable, fierce as lions, hard as steel, and such as can be brought to no atonement, must it not be said that we have shaken off all fear of God?" So again, a chapter that thinks about the sixth commandment should also make us think about the deeper application of the sixth commandment, which we talked about last week, and which the New Testament emphasizes especially, and that is that we are supposed to love our neighbor as ourselves and not hate him in our hearts. And Calvin's point is that if an army going to war against a city would first seek peace, how much more should we, who are supposed to seek to be at peace with all men, as Paul says in Romans 12, how much more should we then seek reconciliation as much as possible? But then in the last part of what I had to say, I thought I would try to reflect a little bit on how this points forward to Christ. We've seen this in various parts of Deuteronomy and in various ways. Now, here there's a reminder that Jesus is often presented both in the Old Testament as a prophecy of the Messiah and in the New Testament as a conquering king. Okay? But the striking thing is that the way his kingship operates is quite different from the kingship of men. So think about Psalm 72, for example, which exalts the peace that he brings and the great benefit to those who are under his rule. It does say that kings will bring him tribute, so it makes us think of what happened in this chapter. But specifically in verse 10, again, about the proclaiming an offer of peace, many of the older commentators point out that that's the way Christ, in fact, works. He sends his gospel. He doesn't simply condemn men outright, although he could. He sends his ambassadors of peace to proclaim the gospel to them. But in the end, he does bring judgment on those who ultimately refuse him and rebel against him. And that is particularly spelled out, you might say, in the book of Revelation, and the picture in Revelation 19 of Jesus as going forth to war and those who are at his side and bringing judgment on those who rebel against him, the beast and the book of Revelation and all who side with him. So it is a sobering reminder, if we think war is terrible and if we think the shedding of blood is an awful thing, then we should look ahead to the great judgment and the terrible wrath of God that is against all those who rebel against him. And insofar as we, as the church, fight in the battle, we should sing Psalm 20, right? Some trust in chariots and some in their horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. It can be very discouraging. The church can really think that the world has the technology, whatever that is. And we can be very overwhelmed and we can be tempted to fight without faith in God and fight in a way that really compromises the message by using the means of the world's warfare. But if we're reminded that it is God who fights for us, then we can fight in faith and we can fight in confidence. It is just as a footnote, kind of an interesting fact that the one allusion from the New Testament to this passage seems to be about exemptions. And it's the story that Jesus tells about the man who invited people to a supper, and one after another they began to make excuse. It's not an exemption, it's an excuse. And there's actually a similarity between the excuses they made and the exemptions here. The conclusion might be that there are no exemptions from the Lord's army. When he calls you to fight, when he calls you to faith and to fight, you're to leave whatever you have behind and go and serve him. Okay, so I probably dodged some questions about warfare. Oh, no. John, yes?
Yes, I have a question about verse 14.
Uh-huh.
This is regarding what maybe unbelievers might challenge. And it's not like wiping out other nations, not that challenge. But sometimes it's used as kind of like a God's condoning pillage of rape,
right?
Basically. And I guess my question is, maybe what your response to that would be, or if there's any verses that would challenge that. I don't know.
Yeah. I actually thought of that too. I think in Wilson's debate with what's the guy's name?
Hitchens.
No, sorry. This is the older one. I haven't listened to any of those. The guy who used to be a Christian?
Barker,
yeah. He was a Christian minister or something. He brings up this. I don't remember. I didn't look it up in the. I think he was quoting the King James, but he brings up a verse like this. And I guess I would say if you look ahead to the next chapter, you can see there are provisions for the way the women are to be treated. And so it's not rape and pillaging. The women are to be treated respectfully. In fact, it even says in the next chapter that if after a time you get tired of her, you can't mistreat her. You need to send her off with a provision. So it's clearly that the women were to be treated with respect and not not the sort of thing that's usually thought of. Vicki?
Just along with Calvin's quote about what you have to consider when you're going to war, and when you get a situation like that, how are you going to control
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, right. It's one thing to tell a bunch of men to treat the women well. It's another thing to see it work out in practice. So in terms of the commandment of the scripture, I don't see that here. There is no denying, though, that the people took advantage. They got the spoils of the city. And there's no, I mean, there's no denying that. But I don't see specifically the sort of mistreatment of the women that is sometimes mentioned in connection with this. This will come up more in later chapters. There could well be some accommodation to the current practices. For example, so I'll mention Calvin again. Calvin says specifically the killing of all the males seems to be brutal. But perhaps it was an accommodation to the times, just as later on there's some provisions made for polygamy and divorce that are not, strictly speaking, in accordance with God's law. But the specific question you asked, I don't see that in the passage. Yes, Jeff?
I was thinking about fruit trees in Scripture.
Yeah, right.
And actually, recently I was reading the end of Matthew, where Christ curses the fig tree.
Mm-hmm.
Also, then a little bit later, he tells the disciples not to worry that, you know, you can call on 12,000 angels or whatever.
Right.
But that was us saying that, well, that's one other instance of fruit trees.
Yeah, I didn't put the reference on the board, but Revelation 22:3, in the new heavens and the new earth, the fruit of the trees are for the healing of the nations. It's some commentators, I think actually Gary North, did go back and note the presence of the trees in the original garden. Of course, that's what Revelation is looking back to. And so there's a rich symbolism involved, as well as the practical fact that you had to have something to eat. Yeah. Did you have other thoughts from the passage in Matthew?
Not really, only that this, in that case, he curses the tree because it's not never going to bear fruit.
Right.
So.
Yeah. I think it is, I mean, some of us like to grow trees. Our pear tree blew over in a storm, but it's difficult in Oklahoma, isn't it, Dave? Yeah. But I don't think we realize how much they depended on fruit trees. And fruit would be understood more generally than, like, we would think of just a pear trees. It would include olives and presumably nuts as well. Good. Other comments or questions?
Alan, I thought when Vicki asked about modern applications, I thought you said, well, yeah, quoting Calvin is modern.
That's right. It's early modern, according to current. Yeah, it is a very difficult thing to be in charge of a nation and in charge of an army and make a decision about going to war. And there currently are disincentives for doing so. But I think this chapter does raise questions that any ruler would have to answer if he wanted to be obedient to God. I'm not in a position to answer most of those questions.
In Marvin Olasky's book, The American Leadership Tradition, it's been 10 years since I read or something, but my recollection is he covers how this weighs on leaders,
mm-hmm.
maybe ones that aren't necessarily Christians, at least not at the beginning of their, but how they grew up in a Christian culture and so on, and it does weigh on them quite heavily. So,
yeah, I guess Abraham Lincoln would be an example, and he certainly saw the bloodshed that came out of his decision, right or wrong. Sorry, Dave.
It strikes me as interesting. Providing disincentives to go to war is another characteristic of how the people of Israel are not to be like the other nations.
Right.
I don't know where the critical mass would take place where you become a regional superpower. Certainly they had other nations around them that they were really out of bounds in terms of touching, but there were plenty of nations that had empire building on their mind throughout the history of Israel, and Israel was never given the opportunity of being their own Alexander the Greek, or the great, being Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, they never had a provision to go conquer the entire no problem.
Right.
It's another way in which they stand in very stark contrast to powerful people.
That's a very good point. Good. Dan.
Just to piggyback off of that, and Psalm 20, just seeing how it's Jesus who does conquer the entire world. With the gospel, with a different sort of army and such. So I want to participate in a scorched earth policy. I'm not talking about inquisitions or anything. About taking the gospel to all nations
right.
And seeing that. So that's kind of an interesting thread. And also this notion of disincentive to war. It seems like you mentioned there's something that you said earlier that made me think also at the individual level. We talk about things like self-defense and wars fought defensively and so on. There's a great incentive to be able to fight, say, a defensive war.
Sure.
To defend
right.
oneself and a duty to do so, but first to be a peace seeker. So being willing and desiring to be abused, verbally abused, have your property destroyed, whatever it takes to keep the peace before finally resorting to defense only in kind of an extreme or last resort.
Very good. Good. Good discussion. Let's close in prayer.